Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, the best stories of the week from some of the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Roderick Chambers at 2SERFM in Sydney. Thanks so much for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Coming up on The Wire Weekly today...
And that means that would just open the way for Russia to attack further into Ukraine. You know, to sort of rearm, take a break, and then attack further.
As talks get underway in Alaska between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, it's becoming clear that Putin wants to be given the Donbass region in its entirety, which would seriously damage the defensive capability of Ukraine. And why would he then stop? We have this and more coming up on The Wire Weekly, so keep listening. It's 80 years since Japan surrendered and the Second World War officially ended. Here is how Australia heard the most welcome news from Prime Minister Ben Chifley.
Hello, citizens. The war is over. The Japanese government has accepted the terms of surrender imposed by the Allied nations, and hostilities will now cease. The reply by the Japanese government to the note sent by Britain, the United Nations, the USSR and China has been received and accepted by the Allied Nations. At this moment, let us offer thanks to God. Let us remember those whose lives were given that we may enjoy this glorious moment and may look forward to a peace which they have won for us.
My mother always remembered vividly the end of the war for us in Australia as she was working and in her teens at the electrical manufacturer Australian General Electric. It was VP Day, also known as VJ Day. Germany had capitulated earlier in the year, but Japan had fought on. She was on her way home after work and the trams had stopped down Parramatta Road and she and her friends decided they would go back into town for the celebrations. They were walking back and Mum noticed her father's truck in a side street and he gave them all a lift back on the back of the truck. There were throngs of people, all vehicles stopped in the centre of the city and there was paper coming out of the office windows and they had to sort of wade through it. They threaded their way down from the cenotaph in Martin Place and ended up dancing around the obelisk on Hyde Park with a group of other young girls. And they were filmed by one of the newsreel cameramen. With the help of Peter Luck, the seven journalists who created this fabulous century, I went through much footage trying to find the shot she was in, but sadly without any success. I did see, however, the famous joyful dancing man who was the intro for Peter Luck's series, an iconic moment. But who was that man? There are a few claimants to the identity. Peter Lawler recalls his memory of that day with 1RPH's Marianne Gore.
The war started in September 39. We moved to Burra in the next year, early in the next year.
Tell me what happened in Burra because
of
the war.
We didn't have a wireless till 1942. So the knowledge we got of the war came from Dad talking to Mum and what we overheard. A lot of things did happen in Burra. First of all, the convent school had a big paddock next to it and volunteers, they dug trenches.
So you think that Burra wouldn't actually be a high-value military target?
No, it would not have been. But some of the windows we had to have brown paper over them so that the light didn't show at night.
Right.
I do remember one night there was a very, very heavy thunderstorm and we kids always said, oh, the war's coming, the war's coming. Ed came out and he blew hell out of us. Very early in 1940, just after we moved to Burra, every adult and every child was issued with a ration card. If we went up to the shop to get some butter, we had to present the book to the shopkeeper and he deleted the appropriate coupon. Later on it became, you know, bacon and beef and sugar, a whole range of things.
So I guess your mum and all the households had to do some pretty special cooking to provide meals with a short amount of butter or whatever it was.
When I went to college, because Blankets were very thin and few and far between. Luckily, the college had a cadet corps. So we were issued with uniforms and greatcoats. If we didn't have those heavy overcoats, I think we would have frozen to death in Goulburn. It has to be the coldest town. And, of course, like all Catholic institutions, they built high on a hill. The food at college was porridge for breakfast, afternoon tea, the big billy of tea with milk in it, and some sugar, but not too much. We were allowed, on Thursday nights, we were given a steak dinner.
Mm.
Where that came from, I know not. So getting back to Burua and the war, in August of 1944, the Japanese broke out of the prisoner of war camp. And that caused a lot of concern, of course. Yeah. Other memories of Burua was the returned soldierman came back and he was just skin and bones.
Right.
Mr. Bill Robertson was his name. And the only other thing I can remember was an uncle of mine, my mother's brother, he was up there when the Japanese bombed Darwin.
Right.
I think he was an aircraft gunner. Yep.
Did you remember sitting around the wireless and listening to reports?
No, I don't. Dad didn't stop us using the wireless. I don't ever recall it.
And would you have gone to the movie theatre on the afternoon?
Yeah, well, I think they used to give them threepence or something for every bottle or jar they bought back. You could buy a carton of chewing gum.
That was pretty special.
I don't know how we paid for it, but we must have saved our pocket money.
Do you remember a celebration for VE Day? Yeah.
They knew that the war was ending.
Yep.
On the 15th of August,
yep.
The Burua Rugby, as it was, Rugby League team, played the oldies, and one of the oldies broke his leg, Fernand Dewar.
And this was a celebration.
The only celebration was that football match. I don't think there's any street parade. That. Oh, God. Yeah, that was a big, big day.
And the whole town came out to watch.
Yeah.
Do you remember anything about the dropping of the atom bomb?
No, only what I know from history. Something must have twigged my memory because I had at least two to do things, to go to Hiroshima and the other to go to Auschwitz.
Oh, yeah.
I've been to both of those.
You have? Oh.
And Hiroshima was really something. What they've done in that town now. A beautiful city, and the war memorial is something else. Both cases, man's inhumanity to man. You know, in Hiroshima, they've got this big mound of ashes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with my son-in-law, and when we were walking, three or four college girls came up. Can we speak to you, please? Yes, and they asked us a few things about Australia. Where are you from? You know, listening to the language.
Mm-hmm.
That was somebody special. And then ringing in the big peace bell. Which, incidentally, there's a peace bell in Cowra.
Oh, yes, there is.
Anyway, that was something special too. There you go.
Peter Lawler there, remembering VJ Day with Marianne Gore. President Trump and President Putin are set to meet in Alaska to discuss a pathway for peace in the Russian and Ukrainian war. The White House has tempered expectations for the summit, claiming the meeting is a listening exercise. Russia has emphasized the ceasefire will need to involve Ukrainian territorial concessions, resulting in pushback from President Zelensky and the European community. George Popel has the story.
President Trump and President Putin are set to meet this Friday in Alaska marking the first time a US president has met with Putin since 2021. While the talk is aimed at achieving a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine, experts are pessimistic about the summit. Dr. Sonia Majacek is a professor at the Centre of European Studies at the Australian National University. She believes the talk is undermined from the outset by not including President Zelensky.
It is really unrealistic to go ahead and hold peace talks without the victim. Zelensky himself for several days now has been saying that these talks will be stillborn. That's the word that he uses. They just won't go anywhere unless Ukraine is at the table as well. And of course, European partners have put together, or they're preparing, I believe, a statement, and they are going to be saying the same thing. But anything that's discussing Ukraine needs to involve Ukraine at the table.
The exclusion of Zelensky could also result in Trump being manipulated by Putin.
There seems to be fear, certainly within Ukraine, that a Putin will provide a whole lot of disinformation, basically, and a lot of misinformation, the sort of thing that he's been saying, that historically this is always part of Russia anyway. That sort of thing can be very manipulative. And there's fear that Trump personally will simply listen to that and buy into that. And of course, that's the kind of disinformation that Zelensky would be able to stop and challenge immediately on the spot. So in my view, Putin is actually rather threatened by meeting Zelensky in person.
Russia has put the pressure on Ukraine to concede territory for a ceasefire to be agreed to. However, Ukraine has argued this violates their constitution.
The constitution defines the Ukrainian territory, and Zelensky has been saying that he can't even agree to anything like that without changes to the constitution. Further to that, he's been saying Ukrainians will not gift their land. It would be simply rewarding Russia for what it's done. And to go into a little bit more detail, what's apparently on the table is the Donetsk region. And the problem is that that eastern region, if that were to go in entirety to Russia, it would actually close down the military defence lines that Ukraine has there. And that means that that would just open the way for Russia to attack further into Ukraine, you know, to sort of rearm, take a break, and then attack further. And Zelensky has actually said that as well.
Experts are concerned that if Trump reaches a deal with Russia, he will place undue pressure on Ukraine to agree.
I think rewarding Russia for what it's done would be a very dangerous move for the rest of the world. But I do fear that that's what may happen. Not only commentators, but many people within Ukraine fear that Trump will try to pressure Zelensky into accepting a deal which really is advantageous for Russia. I think it will depend on European leaders really stepping up and supporting Zelensky in not accepting that kind of deal.
The European community are also anxious about the upcoming talks, particularly as there is a fear that if Russia is successful in Ukraine, other neighbouring countries may come under risk of Russian invasion.
If Russia is successful, if Ukraine is militarily defeated, that then poses a threat for the rest of Europe. Putin has openly said that he wants to reinstate the Russian Empire. He wants to reconquer areas that, of course, now are independent countries. He wants to take control of those areas again. And that means Moldova, that means Poland, that means Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. They are the next countries up for grab if Ukraine is defeated.
Dr. Sonia Michak of the Australian National University Centre for European Studies, speaking there with George Popel.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
Food security is something we take for granted. Supermarkets are open every day and we can get whatever we want. But in many parts of the world, the access to regular supplies of daily food and clean water is a problem. Australia can help communities around the world, but as 735 million people are undernourished and a billion do not have a healthy diet, there's much to do. Professor Glenn Denning, Director of the Master of Public Administration and Development Practice at Columbia University in the United States, at the annual Crawford Fund conference on food security, and I asked him what Australia had contributed to food security in our region and the world.
Australia's done a lot historically. Obviously, being a major food exporting country contributes a lot to global food supplies. There's no doubt about that. Done that for decades. In terms of assisting people in low-income developing country settings, the overseas, you know, the international aid programs of Australia over a long period has included agriculture and food security as part of their portfolio and have made some important contributions along the way. You know, my point is that we probably could do a lot more, and it wouldn't necessarily hurt us a great deal. The amount of money we're talking about is very small in the grand scheme of things. We can do a lot by working in partnership with countries in the region, with multilateral development banks and other organizations to really get great leverage from the funds that would go into this area. It's important for Australia. So it's important for Australia because we live in a neighborhood where most of our neighbors, most of, you know, the Pacific, Southeast Asia, Indo-Pacific region, food security is a big priority for them. Because if you don't have food security, you have political instability.
What are the countries that are in most need in this area, and what are the ones where we can have the most impact?
You know, it varies greatly. Like, you know, you can even look at China. I mean, I'm not necessarily saying providing aid and assistance in that sense, but, you know, China is ringing the alarm bells in terms of its own food security. You know, Xi Jinping has said that agriculture is a high priority for the country. It's a national security issue. Our, you know, nearby neighbor Indonesia is likewise really emphasizing food security again more than it has in the last, you know, than in the last 40 or 50 years. They've started a national school meal program to reach 83 million children. And, you know, again, it just reemphasizes the importance that our neighbors are starting to put on this. And the Pacific Island nations, who were really hurt during the COVID period when trade was disrupted, the reason for that is most Pacific nations are net importers of food. So when trade gets disrupted, as it was during COVID, and as it is being to some extent even now, they really hurt. And that's not good for, it's not good for people's, you know, for their livelihoods and for their health, but it's also not good politically as well for these nations.
And we're also pretty good at you know, leveraging technology and bringing that into agriculture and, you know, using things like drones to assist in insect control and seeding and all sorts of things.
Yes.
I think are all coming in. And that's something that we can help these other nations with too, isn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, the future of, you know, the future of agriculture, the future of food systems is, you know, is about digital agriculture and digital approaches to solving some of these, you know, great problems across the whole value chain. Again, as you say, Australia has actually been one of the leaders in that area. It's especially important because of the increased variability we now experience with climate change. And the kinds of quantitative skills, data analytics skills, understanding climate and its impacts on production and distribution of food and on human health, actually, all of these areas are important. And I think we can contribute and we can learn from that experience.
So do you think that we're actually on the way up or the way down at the moment when it comes to food sustainability? Are we getting into a serious situation, or can you see the glimmers of light on the horizon?
Well, I'm sort of half glass full kind of person, so I've tended to look for those glimmers of light. We're making, you know, you mentioned those numbers of people that are hungry. It's coming down. It's actually down to, I think, a little over 670 million, but that's still a lot of people. And it's coming down very slowly. We're certainly nowhere near close to eliminating hunger and malnutrition in the world. So I think we're making progress, but it's not progress by no means fast enough. And so, yeah, I think it's high time we all realize that, and that's why I'm talking to you now. We want to get that message out, not, you know, to the community at large, but also to our political leaders, and so they can take the kinds of actions we need to execute that transformation that's needed.
Professor Glenn Denning, Director of the Master of Public Administration in Development Practice at Columbia University in the United States, speaking with me there.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
We often hear about species of bandicoots, bilbies, or quolls facing the risk of extinction. But did you know there are populations of brush-tailed rock wallabies also facing serious decline? Inhabiting rock piles and mountainous terrain, this nocturnal wallaby with a little black nose and little black feet is still relatively common in southern Queensland. However, in other states, their situation is dire. Now conservation efforts are being done to protect this valuable marsupial from the numerous threats it faces. Tony Pankaluik asked Jessica Guidotti, Project Officer from the Wildlife Preservation Society of Queensland, how the brush-tailed wallabies are faring.
So these guys unfortunately have low genetic diversity due to their kind of habitat. So we're talking usually it's one male has an overlapping range with a couple of females, and that's kind of all there is in that little patch of rock. So there's not much gene flow between that rock and the next rock, especially since we've had things like pastoralism. So we're cutting down all of the trees between those rocky outcrops. So we're kind of limiting gene flow, and then things like fire and reduced abundance. So there's less of them, so they're not moving around as much. So that's kind of leading to a bit of a genetic bottleneck for these guys. The way they do breed all year round. They exhibit this really cool feature called embryonic diapause. And that means that if all of a sudden the conditions change, it gets too cold or too dry, there's not enough food, mum can actually pause the growth of that little fetus until it's good conditions again, and then that baby will grow. And so they're born very, very premature, like most of our animals with pouches in Australia.
Is it true they're extinct in certain parts of Australia?
So these guys used to be common down the southeast coast of Australia, which is a little bit sad now that we know that they're as vulnerable nationally. We used to have them along the Great Dividing Range and down into parts of New South Wales, ACT and Victoria. And the Queensland population and the northern New South Wales population are probably the ones that are doing the best now. They still have fairly good numbers. However, if further down into ACT and Victoria, they're looking really, really bad. There's about 145 sites that used to have rock wallabies at them that no longer do.
Do we know roughly what their population size is?
We use surveys with camera monitoring, and we can use presence or absence data with their poo, and they poo on the little rocks. So we can walk up to an area and say, that looks like really good habitat, and we can have a look around. And if we start seeing some of their poo, we're like, I think there might be some living here. So the way we've set up looking at these animals, there's three different distinct populations. So we've got a southern population, which has about 50 encapsulations, and only a few in the wild. We think there's about 20 wild individuals in that southern population. The central population is doing a little bit better. They've got about 800 to 900 individuals. And then our northern population, so northern New South Wales and Queensland, has about 10,000 to 20,000 individuals. And those populations, we've separated them out like that because they've been genetically isolated for long enough now that there's differences in their genes. So we know that they're not interbreeding. They're quite distinct little populations now.
What are some other efforts being done to protect the animal, to try getting population numbers back up?
So one of the biggest issues with these guys is predation by non-native animals. So we've got our cats, our dogs, and our foxes, and they're a big problem with that young at foot stage, so that when the little ones are getting a bit more independent of mum and dad, because the animals aren't a big species, those little ones are perfect lunch size for some of those introduced predators. So a big part of what the Wildlife Preservation Society of Queensland is doing is we're going out to these core areas within the Queensland population, and we're conducting some predator control on the foxes. So we're hoping to reduce the number of foxes in these sites during peak breeding time, when these little ones will be coming out of the pouch, to give them the best chance of recuperating up into that population to help bring the numbers back up. What we also do is we work with the private landholders as well as parks, because a lot of these ridgelines where the rock wall coyotes live is in national parks because it's not suitable habitat for farmland or other purposes. So it's been left as conservation areas, which is great for us and for these guys. We work on weed management. Lots of these places are really overrun with introduced weeds like our lantana. They affect these guys because it's a really vigorous grower, and after fire it comes back and it takes over their nighttime feeding areas, and so they don't have enough food there. We're also looking at doing some consultations with traditional owners, looking at traditional fire workshops, because fire is a really dangerous threat for these guys. Obviously the rocks where they live at during the day aren't going to burn down, but all of the area up and to the rocks is where they eat, and it's super important for them for predator control. If there's been a fire through, things like cats and dogs and foxes really, really, really do well because there's not much undergrowth, and that's where all of our little prey species live. So these guys don't have anywhere to hide from the predators. So we really need to help work with the local landowners and work with parks on planning out controlled burns so that we don't have catastrophic fires. We're also doing some habitat suitability mapping. So we were going out looking at aerial photographs and see whether we've got them there. And all of that data we're going to put through analysis to work out how connected they are and how well that they're going to spread. And so in the future, if we've got populations that are starting to recover and whether they will be able to spread out into these other habitats. And similarly, things like our reintroduction. So we do have a number of the species in captive bred populations so that if something were to happen to one of our wild populations, we could reintroduce individuals back into the wild.
Jessica Guidotti, Project Officer from the Wildlife Preservation Society of Queensland, speaking there with Tony Pankaluik. And that's it for us on The Wire Weekly this week, but we're going to be back again next week, and of course The Wire will be broadcast each weekday as well. The Wire Weekly is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney, in the country of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It is broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. It's been great to be with you. Stay well. We'll be right back.